All right. Here we are.
We're here. I like that we say it twice an episode.
It's back and better than ever.
Like terrible production value.
Had a summer hiatus, summer vacation.
Summer hiatus, man.
Yep.
I saw your vacation. You were up in the what's it called, man? Where all the white folks go. What's this thing called?
What? Interesting. Martha's Vineyard. However,
Martha's Vineyard.
However, it's actually very diverse.
Oh, I'm happy to hear that, man.
Look up the history of Oak Bluffs.
I'll do that.
You'll see. Oak Bluffs, in particular, Martha's Vineyard is. I mean, it's not diverse wealth wise.
Yeah. Andy, did you just call yourself rich?
No. Martha's Vineyard is. Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Is well,
you know, I don't know, man. When I think of Martha's Vineyard and Nantucket and these places, I just think of like the Kennedys. That's like the first. My brain does not go to like the, you know, Rodriguez's. Okay.
They're all there. Everybody's.
They're there. All there, right? Yeah.
Yeah, because you know why? Because it's fun, and it's yeah. Fun and beautiful. And I think over time, everybody finds their way there.
It's funny, man. It's a part of the country I just haven't spent a lot of time in, and I have to. I want to. I've
been thinking a lot about when COVID, you know, when we move, you know, really, and people are traveling more. I'm thinking about how I want to have a painter's or extended family privacy like trip
Summit.
Someday.
Offset.
That would
offset,
be amazing yeah. Someday. But that's pie in the sky at the moment.
It sure is, man. You it's funny you mentioned, well, not funny, but like it's interesting you mentioned COVID and like the summer, because I was so optimistic at the beginning of the summer that we were like, I don't know, turning the page or the corner or whatever. And man, I feel like we've gone backwards. I had a vacation booked to the Turks and Caicos. I canceled it because I just don't feel, it feels irresponsible for me to hop on a plane and go hang out in the Caribbean. And I've got my booster. I've got all the things, like I've done all the things I've been asked to do. But you know, it feels like dark times again, man. I'm like psychologically trying to navigate it. You know, at the same time, like we talked about this on here before, like I live in Atlanta alone, man. Like I just want to be around my family and my friends. And I did connect with a couple of folks a few weeks ago. I took a trip. I went to LA and met with my book club, and we all like tested before we went, tested when we came home, like did it as responsibly as we could. Didn't like go do a lot of public things, but even that felt like just stressful.
We did an offsite with our leadership team in New Hampshire, and we ate outside. We were outside most of the time, but our meetings were indoors, had to be. Everyone was wearing masks and like everybody had vaccinations and everything. And so,
yeah, yeah.
You know, in one sense, I hear you. It's frustrating that it's not really, you know, kind of moved off. But I think, you know, we're still making it work, and we're still making the effort. And I think that personal interaction, people are really, again, valuing how important that is.
Oh, yeah.
Gonna come back. I have faith, even though the country upsets me in a lot of ways. I have faith that the country, the globe, you know, we'll figure it out. I
hope so, man.
You know,
putting a privacy twist on the whole thing. Remember contact tracing?
Yep.
What a charade that was. I haven't heard us. I don't watch TV, but like I haven't read or heard of it being a discussion point. And what that tells me is like we've lost control, right? Like there's no point in contact tracing. This thing is running wild. But I'm also like curious about like all the companies that were building solutions. And like when I was in California, my Apple phone was like signaling to me like that I could turn on some kind of notification for contact tracing and stuff. I didn't do any of that shit because I didn't want to. But like I just, all that stuff fell by the wayside, but I think the privacy issues involved are still relevant and matter, right?
Yeah. I didn't turn it on either because I got to be, if I'm being totally honest, like, I don't want to know. Like, how's it going to help me?
Yeah.
No. That someone,
I think it's also impossible for you not to come into contact with somebody who's come into contact with COVID at this point, because everybody, like, this thing's running crazy. It's running wild.
Like, yeah,
it's running wild.
All right,
Tecmo Bowl, man. Let's talk about Tom and Tecmo Bowl, man.
We finally got to do Tecmo Bowl, which is a game you and I have talked about a lot.
Favorite, man.
Tom Chavez, the CEO of Catch. This is the third privacy tech CEO we've had, so we really haven't had that many. And so
he's a big one though. I mean, Crux is a big deal.
He founded and sold Crux to Salesforce, which is a large data management platform in the ad tech space. Probably the second largest, maybe behind Blue Kai.
Who knows? It could be the biggest now. I mean, I don't know. Adobe's got a pretty big one too. Like, who knows? But it was definitely, when I was at Oracle, Crux was a big player.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it still is. Crux is a good company too, man. We did a lot of work with them. Really well managed place back then, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. He's, I always find it interesting for, like, people that back into privacy through different avenues. So his avenue to privacy is interesting. Similar to ours, I'd say, although we come from the legal angle. But I'm super,
yeah, I'm excited to talk to him. And like, and do a lot of Bo Jackson references. Bo Jackson, the hero of Tecmo Bowl, Super Tecmo Bowl, and all that stuff.
Yeah, we're gonna talk.
Is Bo Jackson? I know he's not like. Is he the most athletic human being who ever lived? He could be, man.
He's up there. He's up there.
I went to Auburn University for whatever. I honestly don't remember why I was there. Maybe to talk about privacy or some shit. And I went and like just toured the campus. And obviously there's a huge statue of Bo Jackson at Auburn University. And then somewhere, and I honestly, it's a little fuzzy, but I do remember this. Somewhere there's like a school records list or like athletic records in sports at Auburn. I felt like Bo Jackson, like, I mean, Bo Jackson had like, besides, I guess, basketball, he had like every record, track and field and baseball. And
he's up there.
Maybe this was just high school. I don't remember where I saw this, but wherever I saw this, I felt like, how can this person be the best at all of these things all at once? And then he went into the major leagues and the NFL and was literally he was definitely the best football player at the time, I would argue, and an elite baseball player, definitely the best outfielder at the time. How do you do that? What?
Deion Sanders is up there, right? So, like, from an athleticism perspective, some people say the cornerback is the hardest position to play in football. So you could posit that, but Deion wasn't nearly as good at baseball as Bo Jackson.
Not close. I mean, if we're going to get weird like that, Allen Iverson, if you go look at Allen Iverson's high school film, he's one of the best high school quarterbacks I've ever seen. He was unbelievable. And Randy Moss, tremendous basketball player, tremendous football player. So like, there's some other examples out there of like, just like versatile grades. I don't know.
Who's the guy from Cal who played Antonio Gates?
Another
incredible athlete.
Yeah, he makes no sense as a body.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, just ridiculous. Anyway,
Tom Brady is an amazing baseball player. I mean, there's
what?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Well, Tom Brady also is like, Tom Brady shouldn't be as good at football as he is. He can't run, he can't walk, he's not fast, he's not particularly tall, he's not athletic, he's just great. I don't know how he does it. Like, it's like Babe Ruth. Like, you look at Babe Ruth and you're like, what? Babe Ruth is arguably the best pitcher of all time. No, I think Satchel Paige is the best pitcher of all time, but like, Babe Ruth is one of the great pitchers of all time, and nobody even thinks of him as a pitcher because he was that good a hitter, right? Like, it's just outrageous.
I think what makes Brady really good is he's incredibly accurate, and that's not something that people talk about very much. Like, you know, he doesn't have the biggest arm, you know, he's just incredibly accurate. And
he's not the best at anything except winning. And that's the most important thing to be.
He's the best at being accurate and being good looking. And those are two good combos.
There's that. Well, I mean, I think Tom, who's joining us in a second, has a lot of all of these guys' attributes. Like, he's agile, he's nimble, he's built all these businesses. I'm excited to pick his brain on Catch, because I'm fascinated by the company. I think it's on the path to do something really interesting in privacy.
Agreed. All right, here it is.
Boom.
All right, here we are.
We're here.
We're back.
We've been a little sabbatical.
We've got Tom Chavez, the CEO of Catch, with us today. Welcome. Thanks for being here with us between two ferns. Love the background.
Between two ferns. Can we talk about how excellent Between Two Ferns as a show is? Because it's one of the funniest deadpan comedy, like, concepts I've seen, man. It's hilarious to me.
It's just so weird, and they stay right on it, right? He never breaks character, and I love how all of the guests are part of the conceit, you know? Like, they all, like, I don't know if you saw the one with Obama.
It's excellent.
Such good stuff.
Oh, my God. Excellent. I also love the one with Justin Bieber, where he acts like Justin Bieber's not like a famous pop star.
Right.
And then the Jerry Seinfeld one with the Cardi B cameo was strong.
And wait, one more where he has like the parade of beautiful Hollywood actresses coming in, and then they talk for a little bit. He says, "Yeah, you're boring me," and then he punches the red button and then they're off quickly.
It's a good show. It's a good show.
I love it. Before we get into substance, Tom, you and Pedro in particular like hip hop, so I do want to give some airtime, because I think it's while we're the season four is themed on video games, and we picked Tecmo Bowl, and frankly that one's got the GOAT Bo Jackson in it, who's unstoppable. So it was a great episode to pick, but I do want to talk about hip hop, because we've had a bunch of hip hop episodes, but the impact on hip hop has had for you, you know, maybe if it's 80s or 90s or whatever, how did that impact you?
Well, listen, first, before I answer that, I got to give props to Pedro, because in the prior versions, I saw Notorious B.I.G. in your background. Now you've shifted it to Tupac. Let me tell you, I have a picture that's very precious to me. We'll do this fast. In the sale of my first company, Wrapped, to Microsoft, we had help from bankers, and you can't walk around the office, talking about, saying the names of these bankers. So you have to give them code names. And one of the only great privileges a CEO receives is to name the players, to give them acronyms or other names. So we had Snoop, we had Dre, we had Luda Biscuit, and we had Luda, who were the players. And so, we sold the company for a certain amount of money, which was great. But I've told people the most priceless moment of all is when one of our sort of very formidable patrician venture capitalists is on a call with Goldman Sachs and says, yeah. Well, it's nice to know what Luda thinks, but has anybody talked to Dre? Using my code names, which was awesome. And maybe that's evidence of how far hip hop has been for me, right? I don't, and it's funny because I play piano and I'm still a musician, and my mom always wanted me to just focus on the classical music, but I started playing jazz and, played jazz very seriously. And then in like the late 80s, I was on the East Coast at the time, and Run DMC and those groups were doing their thing. And then you started to have this kind of different level of innovation where like Third Bass and other groups were coming up. But I have to have you visualize like a bunch of East Coast geeks dancing on tables, fists pumping in the air to NWA's Fuck the Police. Like the cognitive dissonance is crazy, because these are not street savvy boys. I don't know. I just heard it and it just grabbed me. It just
good music. Good music is good music, right? And irrespective of anything else there. Your story is so interesting. Like, it made me think about my last company and the bankers we worked with who were excellent. But like, I gotta say, if we had Snoop representing us on as the banker, I think we would have sold quicker.
So. You mean like the real Snoop, I hope.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think if let me say this really important philosophical observation. If you add Snoop Dogg to anything, it gets better.
Right.
Including like my family. Anything. Anything Snoop touches becomes more interesting and cooler. Hard stop. Like, look at him. People say that like Jay-Z, Tupac, Notorious, B.I.G., maybe a couple others are like the, you know, scions of rap or whatever, right? I have made the argument multiple times that Snoop Dogg is the not only most influential rapper of all time, the most famous rapper of all time, because he literally is cross-genre. His right. career has not waffled. He's been consistent for almost 30 years. He's been around since before like hip hop was mainstream, and now he's the most mainstream out of all of them. I mean, he's got a show with Martha Stewart. He's on with Ellen. He's, you know, he's on talk shows. He's on WWE wrestling. He goes to the White House. He's got a, he sells marijuana. He sells clothes. He like, he does everything. Snoop Dogg is the most successful hip hop artist of all time. If the only function isn't money, right? And even on the money side, it's not like he's out here struggling. So like, that's my thesis about Snoop Dogg.
100% Pedro. In fact, the coda to the banking story is that after we sold, my team got me a big photo of Snoop Dogg. So I have signed by Snoop.
And that's pretty sick.
It sits right on top of my desk at work. But listen, I mean, he's the Miles Davis of hip hop, right?
He really is. No, he really is. He wrote and starred in the most, what is arguably the best hip hop song ever, which is Nothing But a G Thing, because it was like genre bending. I mean, there's a few things in life that I know everyone likes, even if they don't admit it. Coca-Cola. Like, I've never heard anyone, I tasted Coca-Cola, it tastes like shit. You might not drink it. You might think it's bad for you. You might think that it's whatever. But nobody's tasted Coca-Cola in my presence, or have I heard of anybody who tasted it and goes, that's disgusting. And right? Nothing But a G Thing is a song like that. You could be the most classical, I only listen to fucking Mozart in dark rooms while I smoke cigars kind of guy. If you listen to Nothing But a G Thing, you're going to bob your head, guaranteed.
Universal.
It's universally an amazing song, and it's just good.
Tom, what do you
privacy chat?
So, Pedro, you mentioned some of the hip hop greats, like if there's a Rushmore of hip hop people. Tom, like, what do you take from? Do you take anything from those people in starting companies and running companies? Like on the one side they're artists, and the other side they're business people. So, what do you take from that at all?
No, there's a sensibility, right, to hip hop, which is about, it's this kind of complicated blend of authenticity and rule breaking, right? And when I think about company building, it's, you know, it's a renegade rule breaking crazy ass thing to do, right? To hang a shingle out and say, okay, we're starting a company. I started this company, and I play the tape back now. And I marvel at like how irrational the whole thing was. Like, really? Like, what was I thinking? You know, I didn't really have resources. I charged up my credit cards. I was 28 years old. I charged up $85,000 worth of credit card debt. I didn't have a fallback. I didn't have a salary, but just, you know, crazed with this idea. And I think hip hop is similarly improbable. You know what I mean? Like if you think about how it was born and the twists that it's taken, as Pedro's talking about, the reinvention, like that's the other thing that calls out to me in terms of company building. You're constantly course correcting, reinventing, like Snoop, right? You can't get stuck in your rut. And so, yeah, I think the sensibility and the mindset of hip hop actually has quite a lot, you know, resonates with company building in a pretty natural way.
What's fascinating to me, and we'll move on to privacy, but what's fascinating to me about rap music and hip hop culture altogether and it coming mainstream. Like, I mean, I grew up in the 80s and 90s in places where hip hop reflected the reality, right? Of what I saw. So that's why the genre resonated with me as a young kid. Because I looked around and said, yeah, I see what these songs are talking about all around me. And it gave us a voice, you know, particularly Latino and Black people. In American ghettos, a voice to express themselves artistically, a channel, a vessel to express ourselves artistically. I'm not a musician by any means of the imagination, but I will say, like, hip hop has multiple elements, right? Like, you've got the graffiti element, the the breakdancing element, the DJing element, the MCing element, you know, whatever. And I definitely took a permanent marker to walls when I was a kid, right? And participated in the like proliferation of hip hop culture. And what's fascinating about the point you make about rogueness, like when we did these things, we were actually breaking rules, right? Like when teenagers went and I'm not art talented, but I saw some talented graffiti artists go and paint some amazing murals and incredible art. It was frowned upon. It was looked at as a bad thing. Same thing for rap music and cursing and whatever. And what I worry about now is like, as it's gotten commoditized, the biggest benefactors of this will ultimately, unless we're careful, be like massive corporations that don't involve the people who took the most risks to create the culture itself.
Right.
Like the people who took the risks in the 80s and the 90s should be the benefactors of the, or at least partial benefactors of all of the wealth being generated here. Right. But when I look at like foundational people, like literally the guy who invented tagging in New York City, you know, he lives in some shit apartment in New York. Right. Like, that's not fair. Like the guy invented an entire art form. Right. Like, we don't treat Picasso that way. You know, why, you know, like, why is Banksy getting rich off of an appropriation? Right. Like, these things trouble me. So anyway, privacy, Andy, take us to the right place, man.
Okay. Well, so Tom, like, tell us, like, let's start here. Like, you're the CEO of this company, Catch, but there's a couple other entities floating around too. You've got it sounds like you've got your hands in a couple different things. I want to hear about those things as well, but can you first start with Crux and Salesforce? Pedro used to work at Salesforce, and we were both steeped in ad tech. So how did you, I'm really interested in how you got the sense of the need for Crux, something like at that technology, you're probably going up against Blue Kai at that time. Like, how did you think that through? And then when did like privacy enter your consciousness? Cause I'm guessing it entered around the same time we were all doing the same stuff.
Yeah, I mean, we were all, I think, sort of in the boiler room of ad tech and maybe seeing some worrisome things, right, that brings us all to privacy. But so the inside baseball on Crux and me and privacy is that actually when Vivek, my co-founder and long-term collaborator, Vivek and I were sitting at a kitchen table trying to conceptualize what Crux could be. And I kind of tell you, like, coming off the project before that, a company called Wrapped, we started to have this intuition that, you know, data, and of course you say that now in 2021 and everybody's like, yeah, data, of course. I mean, that's fundamental. But we had this feeling that data was sort of the steel thread that was going to run through anything we did. In fact, we named the company Crux because there was a moment at the kitchen table like, oh yeah, data is the crux of the matter, right? And so we, you know, there you have kind of a concept maybe on its way to a plan and eventually a company, right? But our initial ridiculous idea was actually emulating a company everyone's forgotten then, but I want to give them a shout out. It was a company called Bynamite with a B. I don't know if you guys remember Bynamite. It was some ex-Google guys. And they started with this premise that, look, your data is your property and it's precious. And let us give you a way to provision and control the data. Let us be the fiduciaries of your data so that you can give it to the people, companies, places where you want it to go. And Vivek and I felt like, okay, that just glistens, this idea of giving people control over their personal data signatures, right? And we thought, wouldn't it be cool if maybe just go start buying billboards and presenting ourselves as your personal data vault, right? We actually built something called Crux Consumer. It was the first thing we did, which was a way of giving a consumer a chance to come in and specify these kinds of controls. And then we would propagate the controls that you gave us into the infrastructure we were building, which came to be known as DMP. So we built this thing, you know, basically, I don't know, we put it out there and we were nudging and marketing it. Maybe 2,000 people came, right, to the website to actually do it. It was 2010, 2011. Nobody cared, right? Nobody cared.
That was early for that.
I think my mom came to the website 3 or 4 times just to show support, okay?
I'm the Packard Bell, right?
Right. So I mean, so we said, all right, well, you know, we got a lot of passion for this, but nobody else does. We went off and built a data security product that was helping websites manage and monitor who was skimming cookie data from their sites at the time. And then we got on to all of the bits that people kind of associate with DMP and the remainder of Crux. But I dwell on this because, you know, we, for strange reasons, we don't quite know why, we have this chromosomal imbalance that makes us, you know, really passionate about privacy. And I think it was also just seeing, like, you guys, you know, you see the way third-party cookies are kind of coming in the back door and taking lots of data from websites. I go to the New York Times, I want to be in a first-party relationship with the New York Times. Who are these other guys who are coming in the caboose and doing things with data? That kind of unsettled us, right? So fast forward to Catch, and it's a very different time, right, than it was a decade ago, right? Now people are really attentive to who has my data, what's happening with my data most. And listen, most consumers are happy to trade off security for convenience and care less about these things. But there's a growing number of people, and obviously a new set of regulations that we didn't have back then that just create more of this impetus now for companies and citizens to get it right. So
did you worry, like, that it was a crowded space? It's interesting, like, because right now we know this, you know, we're in this moment where you're, it was interesting, right? You're describing when it was nascent for all of us, and it, like, GDPR hits us like a ton of bricks, and Pedro and I went through that together a lot. Did you have concern, like, in going to start Catch, that you were entering maybe, like, that it's crowded and there's a lot of activity in this space and a lot of overlap?
So I have a funny view of these things. And actually it's a result of my first company, where we were total pioneers in this area called price optimization at the time. And as a puppy at the time, I thought, like, yes, you know, and first time entrepreneurs love to talk about, when asked by venture capitalists, who are your competition? And you say, there is no competition. We're one of a kind, right? So I went through all that pain in building that company. And one of the big lessons learned was, oh, no, you want to show up at an arena where there are lots of contenders, right? You mentioned Crux and you mentioned Blue Kai. Well, there was Blue Kai, there was Audience Science, there was Demdex, that Adobe bought, all of these other companies. There was a lot of contenders, right? And so my whole approach to all of this, and in Silicon Valley, a lot of people look to talk about first mover advantage and how early birds get the worm. I'm all about, you know, the second mouse gets the cheese, right? I mean, I'd rather be behind.
That's such a good point. Like, as the GC of a venture-backed company, I can't tell you how many times you get the set of questions like, well, okay, what's the reality of the market? What, like, is your TAM, is your total addressable market real? What is it? Who's in the space already? If you're able to say Blue Kai's in the space already, XYZ, couple other players are in the space, but here's what differentiates us from them and how we're going to jump in. Like, I've always been interested by the idea that someone would be, like, all about first mover, because I agree with you. Like, the second mouse has a lot to look at.
Yeah, listen. And it also reflects something of our sort of makeup, right? We are, for better or worse, we're a bunch of, you know, sort of hardcore product technology geeks. You know, like, we want to build a better mousetrap. And there's no ego. Like, we don't have to invent the concepts and the frameworks from scratch. It's just, so from a company building perspective, I mean, map back again to that first company. When my board used to tell me, oh, look, Tom, I mean, these are missionary sales. And I remember once I had the presence of mind to sort of snap back and say, dudes, these are not missionary sales. These are exorcisms, right? By the power of Christ, I command you to buy this software. Those kinds of sales cycles are really rough. Right. I mean, if you're a company, you want to participate in a larger market that's hopefully better understood. Right. And by the way, again, what a decade what a difference a decade makes. Privacy is really well understood, right? It's really top of mind. And on the second mouse gets the cheese, since we've got Pedro with us, I always love to mention Facebook in this context, right? There was Friendster, and then there was MySpace, and then there was Facebook, right? If you're old like we are, you remember those. And I would actually posit that without Friendster and MySpace sort of tilling the soil and doing what they did, I mean, Facebook would still...
No, I think you're absolutely right. While you were talking, I was thinking the same thing about Facebook. And look, I worked for another company, Salesforce, that also wasn't first at what they do. And they're clearly a very big player in what they do, or the biggest. Speaking of Salesforce, Robert Cunningham, does that ring a bell?
Of course.
Robert. Yeah. Robert and I overlapped at Salesforce for a while. And I know he's now, you're the head of legal at Catch and your shop. He's one of the good ones. It was a good grab when you guys pulled him over to your side. And I'll say one thing about Robert, and I don't know what he looks like now, but during COVID, he and I were kind of at the beginning of COVID. We were competing on like best COVID beard. He won. His was Santa Claus-esque at one point. It was very strong.
I think I was there, Pedro, for the Revenant look.
Oh, okay. Were you still there? Okay.
he's clipped it back a little bit now. It's nice and it's a lot tidier.
But, okay, good.
When I joined Alice, I got on a call right at the very beginning with one of our outside counsel who I knew previously. And I hadn't seen him in a long time. I was just kind of like in day one, you know, like, okay, give me the lay of the land here. And he logs onto Zoom and he has a beard. It's red. And I swear it was like down to here, you know, and I'm used, this guy is at a major law firm. I'm used to him being like pressed shirt all the time. I'm like, whoa, what's going on with you? I think he still got it too.
I hope he keeps it, man. Like, we all need to be a little bit more disheveled, you know, like, let the wolf inside of us free a little bit, I think is the move. But Tom, let me ask you, so I've got some inside knowledge into what the company does because I know Elisa and Robert and others who work there. So but I'd love to hear you give like the, you know, 10 to 30 second, what does Catch do elevator speech for the folks that aren't as familiar with the company?
Sure. Yeah, look, Catch has technology, infrastructure, and APIs to make privacy and data governance programmatic. We talk a lot about making privacy programmatic. It needs, you know, privacy in its current stage, as it needed to be, was heavily focused on the rules, frameworks, policies that companies need to adhere to. We take that seriously, and we want to build from that. We do some of that, but our core sort of power is delivering technology to create so that privacy becomes a set it and forget it premise for the companies who adopt our solution, right? When the privacy demons go bump in the night, when a citizen in some other geography issues a complex rights request, our infrastructure handles programmatically and not in sort of the kind of manual, laborious way that we see too many companies handling it today. Since the three of us come from the ad tech arena, I like to reminisce on, remember the early days, right? When people were posting an ad into their website, they stitched it like an artisanal, precious little thing into their website, right? We all look back at that now and say, oh my God, that's crazy. How did you guys roll like that? The ad server was born, right? And what did the ad server do? It made ads programmatic. You had rectangles on screens and the experience would shift depending on who was on the other side of the screen, right? And where that person was located and so on. Well, let's fast forward to today and invoke that. I mean, privacy needs to become programmatic in exactly that same way. And that's what we're in the business of doing.
So if one trust is a horse and buggy, you guys are like a Rolls, like a Ferrari?
Well.
Or a Tesla?
I'd say, you know, we think of ourselves just more as a model, good old fashioned Model T, but you know, we call it a horseless carriage. We're in that horseless carriage state of the market, right? Where we don't quite know how to refer to these new things. But yes, I think your point, Pedro, is like, yes, getting customers and companies to understand, you know, I think what we see is this kind of mindset out there where people say, well, I can comply with all these regulations and it would be a pride swallowing, soul sucking siege, and I'll stagnate if I do. Or I can ignore all of that and grow through data. And we want people to understand, look, it's possible to comply and grow, right? By putting the machines to work, right? Creating technology that scalably handles all of the complexities that come. And it is hard, right? I mean, I'll confess to the two of you, sometimes when I'm talking to people, like I'll confess that I'm a little nervous when I show up and I talk to two esteemed privacy lawyers like you two, because you know I'm not a privacy expert, right? I'm an engineer who's passionate about operationalizing privacy. And to your point, Pedro, like having people like Elisa and Robert on my team who school me and the rest of us every day, right, about the fast evolving landscape. Like we're not going to show up and pretend to know more than Robert and Elisa do about these dynamics. The nature of our company is one where Robert and Elisa paint the targets, describe, you know, give us the frameworks, and then, you know, we techies rush in and start.
Tom, I think that cuts both ways. I feel the same way when I'm talking to technical founders or the engineers on my team when we're talking about these things. I can talk in platitudes about privacy, having done some of this work, but you know, privacy in today's day and age, right? Like there's two viewpoints, I think that maybe there's more than two, but two big ones that I think you see in the privacy tech space are like people that view privacy as a software as an engineering problem or engineering challenge, and people that view it sort of more just as risk compliance focused. So when you look at Pedro, for example, OneTrust, right now, I think people are viewing OneTrust, it's a compliance solution. It's a documentation solving mechanism. It's vendor management, risk management, et cetera. Whereas where Catch is landing and a couple other companies like it are like, no, we can help you technically. We can build developer tools to actually assist with this. And it's interesting. Like it'll be interesting to see how it settles out. Like, is somebody going to land both planes, or are they going to land sort of simultaneously to the side?
But someone has to, right? Because I think OneTrust is a great company, and I've used it in previous jobs quite a bit. But it's very labor intensive for the buyer. Okay. And like, I used to have to throw lawyers at this thing to like, just get through the process of documenting the compliance. And I had to go back and do the work of figuring out like that, what I was saying in all of these forms was true. That's hard and takes a lot of time and doesn't scale and costs a lot of money. And so I think one of the things that it seems to me that Catch does is it solves some of those problems by automating some of the work that happens between what you document and the investigation to make sure that what you're documenting is true, but also that your practices that you're laying out are consistent with the rules and being automated to stay consistent. I don't know. Maybe I'm misreading the whole thing.
That's on the nose. That's exactly it. And look, the nature of these technology markets is that, you know, something happens in stage one and then another cooler, better, stronger thing happens in stage two and onward to stage three, right? So privacy had to take seriously these laborious document management policy related checklisty kinds of things, right, in this first stage. And when we talk to our customers, many of whom have started with those other kinds of solutions, we always begin by saying you're compliant. Of course you need to be, right? And kudos to you for investing in that way. But to your point, Pedro, we see there's a lot of pain out there. There's a lot of laborious, expensive, bespoke processes, right? And companies are putting the numbers to it and saying, look, I can't afford this. I can't, you know, I can't afford to maintain these little privacy engineering teams doing things on other solutions. I need, you know, we talk about it as deploy once, comply everywhere, right?
Tom, how did you thread the needle? This is one thing I find interesting in privacy tech. How did you thread the needle in raising venture capital and kind of structuring a business that has to, I'm not saying it has to be SaaS, but it has to have SaaS revenue capable, you know, optics? Like, how did you structure that in your mind? Or how did you get through the business challenge of that? As you thought,
did you just say it has to be sassy?
I didn't say it, but you said it. I'll take it.
It has to be sassy.
It has to be sassy in some way.
We're all about building a sassy pants kind of business. Look, I mean, the what we wanted to do, and we go back, boy, Robert and Alicia listening to this are going to be like, wow, we're fabulous. And they are fabulous. But it comes back to where I didn't feel like we were going to be successful unless we had people like Alicia and Robert who forget more in 30 minutes about the intricacies of these privacy regulations than the rest, most people are going to know altogether, right? And they had to be first class core members of the team. Robert is part of our product team, right? He is intimately involved with the build out of everything we do. So thing one, that's the biggest part of the answer, Andy, is like figuring out how to, and speaking of SaaS, we capture the expertise that are in the brains of people like Robert and Alisa. We systematize it in software, right? Because, and we are a pure SaaS business. We're not gonna have a managed, and we have partners and others that we're fortunate to work with, where there's a managed services kind of consulting aspect that's needed. And by the way, we show up with an informed point of view in our implementations and our interactions with customers, but we're unabashed and we're super clear. We're a technology play, right? Like that's, we gotta just stay focused on that. And by the way, if we try to kind of present ourselves as a legal consulting service, I just don't think we nail it, you know, because it's just, I'm not good at that. It's not, you know, it's not what we're about as a company.
And they got law firms for that. I mean, it's just, you know, whatever.
Once you are able to enable the software connection, the ability to do a data subject request inside of a company's platform, how did you position recurring revenue there for your investors?
Yeah. It's and this is a little, what we do is different from other companies as we understand it. Like we really mean set it and forget it. We don't nickel and dime customers, right? And part of our, it's a little bit like antivirus. Like back in the day, you bought an antivirus package. You know, McAfee couldn't come and say, well, I'm going to help you have these viruses, but if new viruses come along, you're shit out of luck. Like that.
That sounds super valuable.
Sounds familiar though.
So, we got you covered for last year's viruses.
Yeah. We're going all about 2006's viruses. 2021, holy cow.
That's Y2K awesome. Compliant. This thing is Y2K compliant.
Oh, nice.
Right? It's funny, right, to talk about it. But so no, I mean, our job, our premise is there's software and it's in the same way, right? With the same kind of frameworks that we have downloads in our, and I have upgrades, right? We all use software and packages. Actually, before I started this, Zoom wanted to update me. No, not right now. But we do all of these things on the wire programmatically, right? Similarly here at Catch, we want to have a set it and forget it solution so that when you buy a SaaS, you buy software from us in a SaaS subscription model, you have the confidence that it's going to work today and it's going to work tomorrow everywhere, right? Everywhere across the globe, every jurisdiction, every data subject, every citizen, every policy that you decided to implement consistent with, or maybe over the line relative to the policies as they're prescribed, right? We give people the ability to choose and configure, but we handle the rest.
I love that.
What's the next frontier on privacy, Tom? Like, what's next? And well, I hope that's wine you're drinking. I hope that's wine, by the way. Can you confirm that that's wine?
I drink bourbon first thing in the morning. No, this is
Pedro, we were of the same mind, because I was going to ask the same question that you were, but in the context of Bo Jackson and Tecmo Bowl,
even better. Go,
the most dominant player in Tecmo Bowl ever, because you could just run him up and back and up and back.
Let's be clear about how we're talking about Tecmo Super Bowl, I think, right? Is that the one? Because that's where I think it was
Super Tecmo Bowl.
Super Tecmo Bowl, whatever.
And the Raiders, he was unstoppable.
You could be on the 1 yard line, first and goal with Bo. This is how dominant he was. You'd be on the 1 yard line, first and goal with Bo Jackson and the Raiders. You could run all the way back into your home end zone and then run the ball all the way back across the field. And if you knew what you were doing, you were going to score every single time.
Well, that's sort of why we picked it. You know, like not that Tom's scoring touchdowns every single moment of his life, but like your career has had some of that. Like, okay, I'm running ahead of things, right? And privacy is the thing. And so I was going to ask Pedro, okay, like once you succeed with catch, what, like, do you see anything else? Like, is it?
Yeah. Once you solve this, what's next?
So there have been these other companies, and every one of them is beautiful. I love company building, right? But with catch, this feels so different for all of us, because the space is so ridiculously huge, right? And so, yeah, stage one, speaking of stages, is privacy, right? But our conception is that, you know, data governance is that larger circle that encompasses privacy. But, and by the way, we're already working with customers who are B2B businesses who don't have a privacy regulation they're concerned with, but they still have a similar concern with the control of data, right? You know, especially financial companies, right? They're concerned with who gets access to what data, when and why, for what reason, and how do we create programmatic control for those kinds of use cases. So the stage two is data governance, where policy managed data governance, we like to say, is its most urgent near-term use case is privacy compliance, for sure, right? But if you're a financial services, or if you're a bank, right, and you're doing trades with hedge funds and other parties, right, you have regulatory commitments to make sure that the data is under lock and key and is never breached. You have business requirements that compel you to ensure that certain employees or certain stakeholders can't get access to the size of the trades. Think about it, right? There's a lot of precious information flowing back and forth here. So the ability, using the exact same infrastructure we built for privacy, we bring that now to these questions of data governance, right? For those kinds of companies.
It's almost like you view like catch as potentially, you know, someday like the bridge of the Starship Enterprise that sort of sits up top, right? And you've got Google Cloud or AWS and then all your connected like databases and systems, and is it the instrument panel?
You got me, Andy. Like, that's all. I mean, like, we really envision this, and we don't know, like, speaking of horseless carriages again, I don't know what the market's going to call this 5-10 years from now. No, crux. The funny thing is, my team, like, Tom, can we just, the market's calling it DMP. And I was always the jerk who was like, DMP, data management platform. I don't even know what that means, guys. It's so nondescript. You know, I fought it for too long. And the lesson learned is, like, I'm not smart enough to know what the market's going to call it, but it does become a new kind of data fabric, as you're evoking, Andrew, right? This, with this idea of centralized control, like the bridge of the Starship Enterprise, centralized control with decentralized execution, right? Recognizing that in 2021, hey man, we're all, you know, in the cloud, and there's AWS and GCP and Snowflake, and like we're never gonna have that time in the 1990s where a company has all of its data in a data warehouse in a room. It's never gonna happen again, right?
Iron Mountain.
Yeah.
We're not going back to the Iron Mountain.
So the new database, Is it a new data cloud data system? Is it a new, I don't know, but we have a very clear picture for us as to what we're building towards. And it's not a state of mind. We're actually doing it today.
I love it.
APIs, right? Because the other thing I tell my team is like, look, we're building everything according to APIs that are published. You know, for the geeks who are listening to us, go to developers.catch.com. You can see, you know, everything we do is written to an API that we want other developers and software organizations to use. I tell our team, if our customers or partners start writing consent UX, you know, consent experiences using our APIs that are cooler, better than ours, great. We're gonna celebrate that, right? Because the future we're headed towards is one where, you know, look, in the same way, like let's have a moment of silence and appreciation for Stripe here for a minute.
Oh.
Six lines of code makes all the gore of payment process, and you know, people don't remember, but developers used to spend huge amounts of time writing custom payment processing for e-commerce and so on. Back in the day, Stripe just made it all go away, right? Why isn't there a similar solution for privacy?
Yeah, but here's my hope, and I guess we can end on this, but like the independence of platforms, like, I don't know if platform is even the right word, but solutions like Catch is important to building this out, right? Like, and so, you know, the worst outcome from where I sit, as a non-investor, non-interested party, is that this gets gobbled up by, like, you know, one of the big four or five or whatever SaaS companies, and it becomes this like proprietary B2B thing that you can do if you buy, you know, whatever Microsoft or Oracle or whatever it is. And so I hope you'll fight to stay independent until you're big enough that it doesn't matter. There's a formula for that. It's called Salesforce.
Well, look, I will tell you, you know, look, the first company was bought by a large company. The second one was bought, you know, you wake up every day and you try to do the strategic thing. And then sometimes you become strategic to somebody else. But in this case, Pedro, just know, like, we want to take this one all the way. Speaking of Bo Jackson and end zones, we want to go all the way to the promised land. And we're very happy to delay gratification.
You know? Awesome.
So, yeah, man. We're on it.
Go get him, man.
Yeah.
Go get him, Bo Jackson.
Bo. Tom, thanks for hanging out with us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Thanks for being in the Between Two Ferns pressure cooker.
Between these ferns.
You know, and we, like, Andy and I are very wary of doing like any sort of like marketing things, but like that's not really what this was. It was like an investigation into like this, and I've observed it too, and why I'm so interested and curious about what you're doing at Catch. It's like there's this space and this void there around the automation of like privacy. I don't want to use the word compliance, but like privacy management, that if we solve this thing, and then whether it's you guys or somebody else, if it or a bunch of folks solve it, if it gets solved, it's going to create a lot of opportunity for the practitioners to have the mental bandwidth to like invent new ways of thinking about things. We are so consumed right now as professionals with don't get in trouble, comply, fill out all the forms. Andy, why didn't you fill out the 500 document response to the thing? Like, we're so consumed with like the admin of the administration of privacy compliance that if we don't automate a lot of this, we're not going to have the bandwidth for creativity and inventiveness in like philosophical approaches to privacy, which is, I think, something that like requires a lot of attention and energy, and we just, other than academics, not a lot of people have the time to spend on, and I think we should.
Totally agree with everything you just said, and it's interesting, we've been talking about the solutions for business, right? How do businesses handle, to go full circle, the other thing that's hanging out there is consumers. And they're like, so back to Tom's, you know, very early on statement about what they were originally building at Crux, like, we still haven't solved the control issue for consumers around all of their data across apps, across the phone, you know, all those things. So to me, like, those are the big things hanging out there, right? And the business one, you've got people with, you know, big technical brains attacking the business one. and the consumer one, we're still, I think, circling around it. But when those two things are, you know, they're out there, they're big problems to solve. So
totally, man. At the end of the day, like, privacy is not about compliance, man. Privacy is for the people. And yep. Like, we always got to keep that in perspective.
I like that. Privacy for the people.
It's for the people, man.
We had a 100%. Yeah, look, we started it in 2010 and we had to put it away because nobody cared. Restarted it in 2020. In 2030, we're going to be all the way there.
But I think so.
It won't happen in a month or a quarter or a year, but that's okay.
Thanks for the work you're doing, Tom. Say hi to Rob.
I will say hi.
Thanks,
Tom. He hates it when I call him Rob, by the way. So tell him I called him Rob.
Oh, boy.